This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Daly. Our guest this week is Pam Marone, co-founder and executive chair of the Invasive Species Corporation. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Pam Marone next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's crop insurance industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net, providing individualized protection on more than 530 million acres of farmland. Crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Invasive species cost the global economy over $500 billion annually and $1 trillion overall. Pam Marone, co-founder of the Invasive Species Coalition, says there are over 37,000 invasive species in the world, with 3,500 that are harmful. Marone says we cannot stand by and allow these species to thrive.
So what happens is, when an invasive species comes in, they don't have any natural enemies. So you have to find those natural enemies. They could be predators, parasites. In our case, we're looking for microorganisms. And so when you just let them get to equilibrium, it doesn't happen, because now we have gene sequencing that can sequence the genes of invasive species. And what every single study is showing is that these invaders are built for higher reproductive rate. They're built for invasion. So it's not just that they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. When they get somewhere, they outcompete native species because of that higher reproductive rate. So if you just let them go and just think you're going to get to an equilibrium, you will fundamentally change everything for the worse. You'll lose native plants and other native species, and it's not natural. So it isn't natural when you have an invasive species coming in. But I do hear that all the time.
So Pam, one of the big issues now in the headlines is the New World screwworm that is in Mexico, and the idea of control is that of the release of sterile flies. Is there research that could help this situation? Is it available now, or what needs to be done to make it available?
There are new technologies of gene drive or gene edited flies that are real time today. They could be commercialized in a very short time to supplement the traditional sterile male release. So there's gene drive and gene edited fly work going on with spotted wing Drosophila and many other pests today. The technology's here. So let's fast track it so we can crack this one. I'm sure that we can crack this screwworm fly issue with some of these new technologies, along with the traditional sterile male release.
There is the discussion that humans are involved in spreading these invasive species. But the story recently was an individual that was in Ecuador and was infected with New World screwworm and then brought that into the U.S. Now, it's been suggested that that wasn't a threat to livestock, but still that's an example of how being somewhere, picking up something, and then bringing it within your new borders to an area without a natural enemy, and now you've got a problem.
You know, there are fewer and fewer inspections at airports. I mean, they used to have this dog sniffing, people coming in, and I've seen tourists casually laughing about the produce that they have, like on a train coming into New York or something. And I will rebuke them. They look at me like, who the hell are you? And I'll say, no, this is why you should not be bringing that fruit from Europe into the U.S., because it might have an invasive fruit fly in there. And they look at me sort of sheepishly, you know. So people are not educated in what danger there are to this movement of invasive species around the globe. One of the other big problems is the pet trade. So pets are too lightly regulated, the pet trade, and they're shipped all around the globe, and people get tired of a particular pet and they'll put it outside. How many calls do I get from a national park or someone who says, I have a water body that now has goldfish, giant goldfish that I need to get rid of because they're destroying the native trout. Because someone dumped their goldfish into a pond. They thought they were being, or lake in a national park, and they think they're being, you know, nice about, but no, no. And so that's, so a lot of the fungi, so ones that are harming bats, a lot of the fungi are coming in from pet trade.
Is this not a similar situation to the pythons in Florida?
You got it. So it's very similar to that. And it just keeps happening and happening. And there should be more money for prevention because that is the first line of defense. And if you prevent them from coming in, it is so much less costly to agriculture, forestry, and water resource than it is to control them. Because once they get out of control, look at what's happened with citrus greening, citrus psyllids. Okay, so Florida, every single tree is infected. California is doing its best to contain it. Brazil, losing the battle. It's now at 44% of trees being infected. And they had for a while stemmed it off, but they're spraying every 5 days for citrus psyllid, so they're going down the Florida route. This is very costly for farmers, and so preventing them from coming in is really a lot better. But at the borders, we don't have enough inspectors. In fact, a lot of them have been let go, doged or whatever. I think they're trying to bring some of them back, but a lot of research at USDA and other agencies has been reduced on invasive species, and that's kind of the opposite of what we need to do.
If you were just to concentrate on California, what is the threat of invasive species and the ones that are even on the list right now?
Well, it's been an unprecedented year for invasive species in California. There have been numerous invasive fruit flies. It's been awful. So that means that a lot of people bringing in fruit somehow. But yeah, so every week there's some new fruit fly. I want just one when they shut down and say, okay, we've got that one under control. Then another one pops up. There's a new one that just popped up, the fruit flies. And then certainly I just saw an expansion of the quarantine area for citrus greening, for citrus. This is very bad. So we are worried about getting the spotted lantern fly. A spotted lantern fly was spotted in California, but fortunately it was on a truck. Fortunately, it was caught in time, but we don't want that one to come. Now we have invasive oak borers, different kinds of oak borers. I mean, our native oaks in some areas are now getting decimated. This is very bad. So, we have a lot of them in California. We're a big state, and there's always something every week that is either is coming in, and the quarantine areas are being expanded.
In my area, hardwoods with ash trees and the emerald ash borer has been huge. And, I mean, this is not only a challenge for the tree, but this is a challenge for industry that depends on either oak or ash or other native species.
Yeah, you know, the emerald ash borer is a good example. 200 million ash trees killed, and they're even worried about the native ash in the U.S. being extinct because of the ash borer. And it's just shows you an example of what something can do to devastate. And so again, it's better to keep them out. That's a really good example. Fortunately, we've kept it out of California, and we will continue to try to do so because we do have a lot of ash trees here. But we have other invasive tree species like the oak borers that are coming in is not really a bad thing. And then we have in almonds, we've got a whole bunch of new invasive borers, shockle borers and such that we haven't seen before. There's invasive new species of fungus in almonds and pistachios that have come in this year and the fungicides, the traditional fungicides are not working. So it's on and on, it's on high alert all the time in ag and forestry here, and water now because of the golden mussel. I mean, the golden mussel spread so fast, undetected, and now it's all the way from Port of Stockton all the way down to Southern California. Why do we care about these mussels? They clog up water infrastructure and can clog up a pipe, an irrigation system, in a year or less. So, and they also once they spread, they don't have any predators, and they have really high reproductive rates. And they eat everything in the water, and then it comes really clear, and then the algae form, and they get all these, it gets low oxygen, and the fish die off. There's a fish called the whitefish in the Great Lakes that is in danger of dying out. And we have a project for using our product Zequinox to rehabilitate whitefish habitat. So we're really excited about being able to help some of these things.
So when we talk about extinction or the decline of biodiversity, what's at the top of the list? You'd have to think climate change would be. Where does invasive species rank?
So invasive species are the second largest cause of biodiversity decline. So the first one is land use. So what humans do to land. Okay, so it is up there for sure. With climate change and the habitats of animals and plants and invasive species are changing so that there are more coming in northern areas, so they're able to live in normally warm climate. Species are now able to live certainly further up north, so biologists are monitoring their northward spread. Yes, with climate change, they definitely are changing. The other thing is that, we're trying to reduce the amount of carbon, greenhouse gas emission that we have in the world, and agriculture certainly gets fingered for that. But what happens is when invasive species come in, like let's say it's a borer, then you have to cut down the tree. You have trees, you have to remove trees. You might have fires, like with bark beetles, and then you have fires because of the dead trees. And so, or algae, big algae blooms. This increases carbon dramatically. And so we do, it basically outdoes, it undoes everything we've tried for carbon mitigation. Yeah.
So let's look at the history of agriculture. And for the longest time, controlling weeds was done with tillage, whether it was by hand with a hoe or ultimately to a cultivator. And then we entered the chemical phase where we were controlling yep. weeds with chemistry, and now a phase with biologicals. And as I speak to companies that are heavily investing in biologicals, they say their goal is not to eliminate chemicals, but to use chemicals and biologicals together. So let's talk about some of those weed species that are there and that are detrimental to crop production and how we come to solutions that don't disturb the environment, but rather protect the environment.
Yeah, so just some statistics. $70 billion worth of chemicals, pesticides sold globally. Now biopesticides are $7 billion. So we're talking about 10%. So we're getting up there. But weed control with biologicals is only $300 million. So it's a big area to crack yet. $33 billion worth of chemical herbicides used globally, but only $300 million in biologicals. So that's a big challenge that our company is working on. There's a big opportunity. So, yes, I pioneered decades ago the integration of biologicals plus chemicals in an integrated program. Yes, we don't see... I mean, in 20 years, biologicals will be as big as chemicals the way the growth rates are happening, but we're still going to be seeing integrated programs together with low-risk chemicals and biologicals in programs together for the highest yield and quality that farmers can get. So that's where we see biologicals thriving is in integrated programs.
So let's talk about the trifecta of a genetically engineered crop. That is designed for sustainability, but is also designed for food production. The chemistries that we're able to use and the biologicals. Is this a three-leg stool that will provide a way to combat these invasive species?
It actually is. So I'll give you an example. At my previous company, Marone Bio, now called ProFarm Group, we had have a seed treatment. It's very successful. It's on tens of millions of acres with our partner Alba, and it's called BioST. And we tested that seed treatment against corn rootworm on genetically engineered seed, corn seed, that was engineered to control corn rootworm. And when we added the seed, our seed treatment, it gave better yields than just the traded corn alone. And as the bugs, the corn rootworm started developing resistance to the trait, adding the biological seed treatment even helped it even more. So I do see this, yes, I do see this three-legged stool that there are going to, there, these tools are going to be integrated together. So whether it's a Pivot Bio's gene edited microbe for nitrogen fixation, or now we have we're going to have gene edited crops, not necessarily GMO. We have GMO crops, but a new crop of gene edited crops, and then new technologies like RNA interference and new peptides and things. And I think all of these are going to be used together to tackle the continuing severity of the pests and certainly invasive species we've got coming.
There is a group of people that wants to push back against genetic engineering, that wants to push back against chemistry and even biologicals. What happens if we don't bring these elements to fruition?
So the criticism, you know, there's never been any real evidence that there's any health issues with genetically modified crops. But there is an argument that they haven't been sustainably deployed because now we have widespread weed and pest resistance to genetically engineered crops with single gene traits in them. And so there is an argument there that we now have to use dicamba and 2,4-D instead of glyphosate because overuse of glyphosate for Roundup Ready has caused weed resistance. Okay, you can take that argument on face value and say, okay, these could have been deployed more sustainably so that we didn't have all this weed resistance. So I think what we had a sustainable pest management working group in California. I was on it for 2 years, and we came up with a roadmap. And over and over and over again, we talked about integrated programs and holistic systems. Stop relying on just single tools alone, because that's where the pests have resistance and develop resistance, and then your tools break down. So when you work in a more agroecological way with integrated programs, you know, that's the way to go. And we were pretty much technology agnostic in that report. Knowing that we weren't going to win that one. You know, it's when people have their pet technologies. So we basically said, let the science rule and focus on agroecological principles and integrated holistic systems.
How is it different with biologicals than it would be with chemistry? And what opportunities does this provide?
There's a lot of data now showing that biologicals can enhance soil health by shifting the microbiome to, I would say, better functional groups. So you can increase your nitrogen fix nitrogen, microbes that solubilize and help the plant take up phosphorus, microbes that help the crop reduce stress, and so on. And so this is the beauty of biologicals, that they can shift the soil to a more regenerative state faster than if you did nothing. And there are the studies now showing that synthetic chemicals don't do that. So this is an advantage of biologicals for sure.
How do you have a biological that will attack the weed but leave the plant that you're counting on for food and for fiber alone?
We're working on that. So we're focusing on microbes that produce natural compounds, the chemistries of instead of a microbe that infects and kills a plant. So this way, we don't have to worry about, a living microbe getting out and infecting something else. So, this approach, nature is amazing in what it does. You can find microbes that can do anything you want. You can find microbes that will kill one plant and not another, or one insect and not another. It's just a matter of finding those microbes. And now we have artificial intelligence, machine learning, advanced genomics, bioinformatics, all these different tools to help us find better microbes faster. And it's amazing how much more productive we can be now with the new scientific tools we have.
So you have pushback from some consumers about chemistry and about genetic engineering. How do you sell biologicals to a consumer?
You know, I've never had a problem, amazingly. I'll be sitting on a plane and someone will strike up a conversation and I'll tell them what I do. And they love what we do because they relate to it. Because they understand probiotics in yogurt. And when I explain to them, you know, that kind of thing, that there's good microbes and there's bad microbes, and we find the good microbes, and that there's, you know, 70-year history of safe use of biologicals and never been a health or an environmental incident, and they get it, and I explain how biologicals are very biodegradable because we can't change them from where they are in nature in order to get a faster regulatory. So that way, you know, we can't hook fluorinated compounds on to make them more persistent. They have to be as they are. And so a weakness is that they don't last long enough, maybe as long as a chemical, but the strength is that they are very biodegradable. So, you know, it's interesting. I've not had a lot of consumer pushback throughout my decades of experience. I mean, there are some, but you know, that they don't like any pesticides, but once you explain them, they seem to understand it.
So what does industry in the U.S. and what does Washington need to do to prepare the way for the growth of this side of the industry?
That is a very good question. We have a wonderful land grant system with extension specialists and researchers all over the United States that does the outreach and the technology transfer to farmers. When I talk to deans of the leading land-grant institutions, they all have the same issue, and that is the speed of the world and the speed of new technology is happening faster than the university institutions and the faculty can move to meet farmers' needs. So let's say you have a beautiful research study that the faculty member is doing, and it's going to be a 5-year study, and then at the end 5 years, going to have a beautiful report. They're going to how they're going to outreach that and educate the farmer on that, on the results of that. Well, you know, in this day and age, 5 years is an eternity, and the farmers tell me that the study is probably going to be obsolete by the time they get it. So the deans of the land grants are telling me they need a way to have their faculty work faster with farmers on the farm to demo new technologies faster. And that is really what we need to do. And there's a very low awareness and understanding of biologicals in the land grant specialists and researchers and extension. You know, there are basic things of even what is a biopesticide that's not known. So we have our job there.
Pam, there was information provided a few months ago suggesting that the U.S. is no longer the leader in investment in research at the public level, but yet China and other countries are exceeding what the U.S. is doing in research. How will that affect the long run of this for producers here in the country?
Yes, we have enjoyed having a leadership in science and technology that has given us the most efficient, lowest cost agriculture and food production. And you can argue whether, you know, with the MAHA movement or whatever, whether it's also the healthiest, but regardless, we have an amazing agricultural system here. And indeed, that is because of science and technology leading. Now, China is investing double the research funds into ag research that we are in the United States. This has dramatic implications. We are disinvesting, so the actual research dollars is going down. So we need more research dollars in ag and food research, not less. And because we have big problems to solve, a lot of big problems. We just spent the whole time talking about invasive species, but there is a changing climate, so you know, how are farmers going to deal with the changing weather and soil degradation and enhancing their soils, increasing soil health, and on and on, increasing yields while the population of the world continues to go up. So we need a lot more research, and we need to be investing more because China is definitely taking a leadership position. I see the research papers coming out of China. They're amazing. For example, they have the very best tools in genome mining and gene sequencing and so forth. And so they're characterizing entire ecosystems of microbes on a particular crop. And so then they can put those genes into a database and then mine those and then be able to find and find the next best microbes to be able to enhance the crop. So it's things that I only dream of.
Pam Marone, we want to thank you for being with us on this edition of Open Mic. It's an amazing field that you have ventured into and now in a public company working to solve problems throughout the world, for that matter. Pam, thanks for being here. This is Open Mic, and the guest has the last word today.
Well, it's been a real pleasure, and I will just reemphasize the need for continued investment in agricultural research, artificial intelligence, machine learning, bioinformatics, all the latest tools in order to keep American agriculture competitive and at the forefront of innovation.
Our thanks to Pam Marone, co-founder and executive chair of the Invasive Species Corporation, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Daly.